Hi everyone, this is Lacey here with the Your Line Matters podcast. I'm actually sharing the screen with Marnie Freeman. She's over in BC and she actually lives in Kamloops. So it's really nice to have someone to speak with from BC about Lyme and co-infections. So hello Marnie and welcome officially to the Your Line Matters podcast.
Well, thank you. I'm honored to be here today.
You're welcome. So how long have you lived in the Kamloops area?
I was born and raised in Kamloops.
Oh, wow. If you've lived there that long, are you pretty content? Like, do you think you'll be there for the rest of your life?
Oh, for sure I will be, yes.
Oh, nice.
My family's here. My husband's family's here. I like the climate. I like the access to the outdoors. My grandchildren are going to be here. This is where I'm going to be.
Nice. You've got your resources and family and people around you there. And describe Kamloops, because I have family there, and actually I will be going there near future for a life celebration. So I've been there before. But for listeners, how would you describe sort of the climate there? Like when I'm driving through it, I almost feel like some of the mountainsides look almost a mix of trees slash desert. How would you describe it? Because this is curious for me in terms of potential Lyme and co-infection risk there in that particular type of climate.
I would say that we're known in our summer times as being a desert. Generally speaking, the hills are quite green through April and May. We get a mixed bag depending on the year, but for the most part, we're a fairly dry climate. I mean, I love our summers.
Yeah, from what I've known, they're very warm and toasty there.
Yes, for sure.
Okay, and that makes sense for someone like me that doesn't live there, just driving through where you do. You're kind of like, is it a little bit desert, but there's all this kind of BC greenery. Did you spend much time outdoors growing up then, like out on the trails and things like that? Or did you mostly stay inner city and do other activities?
We went camping with my family when I was growing up. We didn't do a lot of it, but we would go every summer to a BC provincial park and hang out sometimes for 1 or 2 weeks, depending on the year. Growing up here, we don't appreciate exactly what we have with all the lakes in our area, but
right, when, yeah.
we have a beautiful, beautiful province.
I believe that. I haven't even seen all of BC, but there's quite a few on my checklist. So you did some camping. Now, do you ever remember seeing any ticks on your camping adventures or even around the trails in your home city?
I didn't really grow up with much knowledge of ticks at all. In fact, I don't ever remember my parents warning me about the dangers of ticks. The first time I saw a tick in person, it was only 2 years ago when I was out hiking. Now, perhaps I'm more vigilant now for checking and looking. Yeah, no, I didn't grow up with any inkling that there were these tiny creatures out there that could give you a life-threatening disease.
Yeah, you're like many of us. I had no knowledge at all about ticks until somewhere between 20 to 30, where one of my friends said like, oh, you gotta be careful for ticks. And I was like, nah, you know, like I'm not really worried. I've been hiking my whole life. I was that person, but that's the only awareness I ever had of it here for myself.
I found that if you ever talk to someone in forestry in British Columbia, they knew of the dangers of ticks.
Okay.
But other than that, for the average person, you know, not really. We would talk about them. We would talk about ticks in the springtime. And yes, you didn't want to have one buried in your head.
Right.
And I never did, that I know of.
Yeah.
I know that a tick bit me at some point, but I don't know where.
Yeah.
But that was it. You know, I got a little tiny bit in school. But for the most part, still, even today, if you stop someone along the street and ask them if we have Lyme disease here in Kamloops, they would say no, which is absolutely, as you know, incorrect.
Yep, 100% incorrect. Yeah. And for people listening, and you're likely aware, Marnie, that they're documented all over Canada now, whether it be by veterinarians, whether it be by actual people. Yeah, definitely.
If you have birds, deer, white-footed mouse, all of these play a part in our ecosystem for the spread of the disease.
Right.
Right.
And if you take what you just said there, most of the provinces have those things. Yep. Anywhere where wildlife and human life intersect, essentially. And if you look at even here in Calgary, with the river going through, there's plenty of wildlife. And then the outskirts, it intersects there as well. So there's really not that many locations in Calgary where the wildlife doesn't intersect. Even the surrounding small communities around, the deer are right in your backyard. Birds are right in your backyard, everything, gophers, raccoons. And I think our people in the United States are finding that even in large, large inner city parks and things like that. And then it's, again, anywhere wildlife intersects or comes to. And as we know, birds fly everywhere. I have family in the Kelowna area, and in their backyard, two people in their family have now been bitten by a tick. So luckily they had me to bounce that off of really quick, and we got that sorted out. But I hear more and more people around me getting bit. And so, well, I guess I'm kind of leading into it now, which is where some of your advocacy comes into play, and we'll come back to that a little bit later on, but around the education, the prevention. And so, yeah, so that's something exciting that you've done for the Lyme and even the external to Lyme communities. And so we'll chat about that more. But going back to what you were saying, you first saw ticks in the last couple of years. So it sounds like for you, is there sort of some uncertainty around where that bite might have happened, if it happened, or where are you at with that kind of hypothesis on how you contracted Lyme disease and co-infections?
My best guess is that I contracted Lyme and co-infections in the 2008-2009 year.
Okay.
At the time, I wasn't traveling. I was doing a lot of trail running.
Okay, yeah.
I didn't see a tick. I didn't get a rash. I do remember a hellish flu. I remember visiting a doctor probably 10 to 14 days after a flu, saying, I don't know what this is, but I'm not kicking it. And from that point, I recovered from the flu, but I started experiencing some weird symptoms that just started, growing over the years. I often tell people it started with a metal taste in my mouth.
Okay, interesting.
I don't know how many other Lyme patients would say that. I believe the metal taste was from Babesia. When you research that particular parasite and what I was tasting, it's possible that what caused it. The taste eventually went away and other symptoms prevailed. But that's where I started my journey.
Okay, the metallic taste. And even if that might not be the most common, as you know, the specific mix of infections and how long they've had it and their access to treatment and their DNA all affects what they're going to present with. So it's helpful for you to say that you had that metallic taste, because there might be a couple other people who are like, yeah, I was wondering what the heck this metallic taste was. That's not going away anytime soon. And why I have it? So yeah, as a possibility, and in your case, could be related to Lyme and co-infection. So you said 2008, 2009, somewhere around there. How soon after those symptoms, or how did you kind of come to the thought, I wonder if this might be Lyme and or co-infections or Lyme?
Well, it's sure a long story, so I'm going to keep it as brief as I can.
Sure, yeah.
Let's touch on just a few symptoms for our listeners.
Okay.
It's very common to have gut issues. If that's one symptom that many of us share, that could be acid reflux, that could be bloating, that could be issues with your bowels. So I was definitely experiencing acid reflux. I was also experiencing iron deficiency anemia early on.
Okay.
So I was tired. I was run down. Tried many things to increase my iron levels, and I was always, or have been, a healthy eater for a long time, but I wasn't making headway on the iron deficiency. The other early symptoms were the metal taste stopped, but I ended up getting a really bad taste in my mouth, and that ended up lasting for 2 years. I think the foods were hanging around for too long and they weren't digesting properly. That was considered a parasitic infection that I treated. And finally, after 2 years, I got some relief. And then the other symptoms started skyrocketing. Because it took 10 years for me to get an accurate diagnosis. Just so our listeners know, I'm not going to mention them all because we would be here for too long. I'll touch on the main ones.
Sure, yeah.
But it's important to know that Lyme disease mimics more than 300 different illnesses. We are all similar but different. And some of the telltale signs are migrating joint pain. Pain for me was mostly flu-like. I just ached. But migrating joint pain can be very common. The other one that you need to pay attention to is that, generally speaking, we have more than one issue going on in more than one body system. Because our body's divided up into about 5 different systems. And that's how you can tell it apart from other diseases. That's how you need to link the picture together. That maybe you've got something going on with depression and anxiety, and you are also experiencing gut issues. You're tired all the time. The list goes on. Eventually, you're not sleeping at night. The first 5 years were manageable symptoms. I got along okay. And the second 5 years just started going in a downward spiral. By the time I was diagnosed, I didn't feel as if I could keep working. I experienced terrible depression. I was having horrific anxiety. I couldn't be in a room with a lot of people or a lot of stimuli. I always worked in an open office environment and flourished in that setting. Getting me in the room with even family members was sometimes too much for me. I couldn't chop a carrot and carry on a conversation with my husband at the same time. So right. Neurologically, yeah. It was affecting my brain. I didn't find out I had Lyme disease on my own. I had a naturopath that I saw for 8 years when I couldn't get rid of the iron deficiency anemia and the acid reflux because my doctor just wanted to put me on pills and I didn't want to go on those pills. I was just in my early 40s. Mm-hmm. So I was researching some better methods. What could I do long term? But what I found out was that my naturopath, although very knowledgeable, was not Lyme literate. He watched me deteriorate over an 8-year period. And it wasn't until I sort of cleaned house, per se, of my practitioner team, because I'm a trusting person. I like to stick with someone that I know and trust. I wasn't getting better. I was getting worse and I didn't know what to do. I had tried mainstream medicine, although usually I got shut down and ended up having to revert outside of mainstream. I paid for a gastroscopy myself. I went to a neurologist. They were looking for MS. And finally, because I'd passed through menopause through all of this, I'd had a hysterectomy. I didn't know that I'd passed into the next phase of my life. Mm-hmm. So I started hormone therapy because I thought maybe that's it. Maybe it's my holy grail, but it didn't turn out to be. Mm-hmm. And my story is that I started to research a long-term healthcare plan for myself with someone who was knowledgeable in Hashimoto's because I was diagnosed with Hashimoto's and female hormones. I took those two and I said, I need somebody in my corner.
Yeah.
And I took a 10-year health history with me because I really felt like it was such a slow progression to the state that I was in that maybe it was important. I didn't know. I just know when I felt my best, and it had been years and years and years of experiencing a progression in the wrong trajectory.
Right.
So it took a Lyme literate naturopathic doctor because it just was a fluke that this woman that I walked into her office, she was educated in the diagnosis and treatment of Lyme disease. And it took her about 20 minutes to look at me because I told her one of the things that she said stood out was I told her that I can't think. I said, like, I don't know what's going on, but I can't think anymore, which I still find it odd to even verbalize those words. But that's one of that, in addition to, of course, all the other symptoms that she put together, she felt that we could be dealing with a tick-borne illness. Right, and that's right. That it started there. It started there in 2019, right at the beginning of the year.
2019. Sounds like ultimately where sort of things started to shift for you is with a LLND, so Lyme literate naturopathic doctor. And I heard you say earlier on that you were previously treated by a naturopathic doctor. So I'll say ND. I still have teeth missing from my illnesses. I had a lot of jaw and dental infections and things. So I sometimes just say it like the ND, because sometimes my M's and N like Nancy sound the same when it's heard by other people. And so that's a result of the piece that's in my mouth temporarily to solve those issues. So, and for the listeners, again, to hear that, the validity on that, that we're still doing this podcast, even though it's hard to get the words out because of my tooth thing. But anyways, Marnie, going back to what we were saying is I think that this is a good spot for us to just kind of dissect for listeners on the difference between Lyme literate and not Lyme literate for us here in Canada. And you and I can talk this out together here. Like, how do we know? I'm going to use a random name like Joe. Joe here saying he's Lyme literate, but you go to see Joe and Joe doesn't know what mast cell activation syndrome is, or he doesn't know the proper research on mold testing. So it gets a little bit tricky for people to navigate. So what I'm wondering if we can brainstorm for people here right now is, what is a list of diagnoses that a Lyme literate practitioner should really know to be able to properly rule out the things that prevent Lyme healing, like mold? And we'll go a bit more. I'd love to hear more in the future after we brainstorm this, if mold has affected you. I'll name a couple here that I feel, my own personal opinion, this should be very, very well known by any Lyme literate, whether it be a M like Moose, MD, or N like Nancy, ND. So, and when I'm placing orders on the phone, I have to say it so many times, so I always just default to that. I'm like, and I use Moose. It is not just because I'm Canadian. It's just what pops into my head naturally. Anyways, someone here, this is their first experience with Lyme disease. They have no idea how progressed it is in them, like what's to come, anything. So they're looking for a Lyme literate practitioner. What should this practitioner know about? I'll let you answer first if anything comes to the top of your head, and then I'll just jump in and add some that I know prevent or complicate Lyme healing.
Sure. Yeah, I'm feeling like I should have studied up on this.
Oh, no, don't worry about it at all. Don't worry about it at all.
What I would say, first of all, does your practitioner, does he know what the governing body ILADS stands for? And has he or she had any training according to ILADS guidelines? So ILADS stands for the International Lyme and Associated Diseases Society. And my opinion would be that most education and training should stem in some way from that governing body who's been around for more than 20 years.
If you meet a practitioner and they say to you, I'm Lyme literate, what's ILADS? So I don't know if we can officially say that's a red flag, but it's not necessarily a green flag either, that for a practitioner. That's such a good point to bring up, because I've seen on their forum, they're getting more on Lyme disease and co-infections. They're medically backed by science and research. And there's also a lot of medical doctors and functional medicine doctors that are a part of that governing body itself in terms of seminars. If you're having conversation with a practitioner and they have no idea what ILADS is and the newest research for Lyme and co-infections, what's something in between green and red flags?
It's close to red.
Red.
If they don't know what that acronym stands for.
So if they don't yet and they're a practitioner, they need to do their due diligence, because if you're treating a massive, complex, systemic illnesses like this, you need to not be doing harm by not knowing your stuff, like the basics around this, right? So it's not to be messed around with. So if they don't know that and they hear this, this is their sign that they need to pop over to that website right now and learn what that means. No matter Absolutely. What they're, no matter if they're, and like Nancy, Andy, MD, it doesn't matter. They need to know what iLads is. And yep. they should sign up for their emails if they can and become members if they can. Okay, so that's awesome.
I have one more.
This yes, is, please.
Okay, so a Lyme literate practitioner understands wholly that if you have a late stage infection, you cannot heal with antibiotics alone. If you are not supporting your immune system, if you are not detoxing, if you are not understanding your history and what else could be interfering with your ability to heal, then you're going to be led on a longer journey.
Right. And that would sort of fall under potentially unintentionally doing more harm in the long run for that person, taking away time that they could have been getting what they needed and extending it, allowing the bacterial infections to remain in their body and dig further and further into their organs. And to kind of further on what you said, when somebody is late stage slash neuro, often their bodies have started to experience a systemic shutdown or malfunctioning. The organ systems, they're pretty much needed to be able to tolerate a heavy dose of antibiotics because there's processing in the liver, the intestines, you have to be able to catch the toxins and move them out. Your body does need to have a certain amount of function to tolerate heavy duty antibiotics, which many of us in late stage neuro are not quite able to do. Now, there might be some exceptions to that where that is their protocol, but it's rarely, if ever, just antibiotics for long-term chronic late stage neuro. So there's all these knowledge pieces that sort of need to be there. And they need to make a clinical decision and offer you like, okay, so based on where you're at, your body, what you can tolerate, here's the Lyme and co-infection treatments you might tolerate. Any other ones come to mind for you, Marnie, or would you like me to?
Before I wanted to know, do our listeners already understand what a Herxheimer reaction is or a Herx? Do we need to talk about that?
Marnie,
a little bit.
We need to a smidgen for the listeners. Yes. Let's talk about that. Okay. Let's just do this. Marnie, what did your Herxes feel like? If you take a bit to kind of remember there, if you need to.
I was a little different than the most people.
But that's great. That's exactly because you want to call out to the outliers.
My Herx reactions basically upgraded my existing symptoms, but never to the point where I was debilitated, which is supposed to be how your treatment plan goes. But I was very careful about introducing a regular extra detox routine. I used primarily infrared heat, and when I couldn't access infrared heat, I used Epsom salt baths and dry brushing.
Okay, yeah.
But we, as Lyme patients, need another avenue to help our bodies detox from the die-off, because the toxins that are released when the bacteria dies off are brutal on our body. And we have to slow down our treatment if the Herxheimer reaction is too strong, because we are trying to find something in the middle ground there where treatment is going to be hard and you're going to feel sicker and you're going to feel worse for some time, but it shouldn't, put you in so much pain or take you from a functioning individual to a non-functioning person. You need to perhaps back off a little bit or up your detox, right?
Yeah.
That's
very well said. I don't think I could have said it any better myself, to be honest. I don't have much to add to that, except what I will say so people can hear mine, because I think not everybody had my type of Herxes either. Mine were heavy agitation and psychological, like just like terrified, kind of like wanting just like help. But kind of like if I could put words, I'd just be like, ah, like I couldn't expel the energy. I just like, so mine were pretty severe mental health wise, in addition to the physical symptoms feeling worse too, just not feeling well and such. But yeah, exactly what Marnie said. I don't feel like I need to add anything to that description at all. That's a HERX. Yeah, there's all different presentations. No one HERX will be the same. But again, if you're looking for a practitioner, they should be respecting if you say that was actually too much. They should be adjusting accordingly to, you know, they can't really go by just one thing. They have to adjust it based on the individual person. And so that's also good to know. I'll add in a couple more of the big ones that are known to prevent or complicate or slow Lyme disease healing. I'll leave the one that we're going to talk about till last, mold. The other thing that I would say a practitioner should be pretty well educated on the testing and treatment at the least, very least, and what that looks like in a person so that they can actually tell that person a recommendation if that's affecting the healing. For me, that would be CIRS, chronic inflammatory response syndrome, because that's kind of tied into sometimes mold exposures and things like that. There's a whole protocol sometimes that needs to be done early on or in conjunction with Lyme and co-infection for some people, but you need to sometimes get the CIRS in control early on. I would say there's certifications for that. It's not necessarily that they have to have those certifications. They need to have the CIRS questionnaire screener, and they need to know that there's blood testing that can be sent away to heavily show that you might have CIRS affecting the whole greater picture of Lyme and co-infections. So that would be one I'd add on there. The other ones I would add on there would be mast cell activation syndrome, the short abbreviation, if you hear it on this podcast going forward, is MCAS. And then the other one would be multiple chemical sensitivity, so MCS. Feel like I might be forgetting some abbreviations. And then the other common ones would be if parasites are affecting your intestinal function and ability to heal from Lyme, and would also be if Candida sort of taken a larger role in your body that it's meant to have, because we do have a little bit of Candida in us, but that will start to prevent and mess up the speed of healing as well. Any other ones that I'm forgetting, Marnie?
I could say definitely there are patients out there who, if they were to do this all over again, would have an extra look at their gut and what foods that they may or may not be sensitive to.
Right. There's even GI panel testings and sensitivity testing they might be able to do. But I'll let you carry on there with the gut, because it sounds like that was pretty pivotal in...
Well, I know someone personally, even in remission and even after, you know, a few years of functioning in remission, things were still not where they should be. I mean, greatly interfering with quality of life. And it turned out that it was a functional medicine doctor that actually, not a Lyme literate doctor, that actually brought the attention to, it's called leaky gut.
Right. And, yes.
And I didn't have personal experience with that, but I do know of someone that did. And it was a game changer. We all have these different paths that we need to go through to get to wellness. For me, personally, neural retraining, that has been my game changer. And I wish I had started it earlier on in my treatment. Neural retraining is where, through our journey through diagnosis and treatment, the neural pathways in our brains have actually changed and they form a loop. And they keep our immune systems overreacting and they keep our nervous systems in a dysregulated state. And I can say that just those two issues alone can keep you sick and keep you from functioning and working at, you know, being joyful and happy and having energy. And, you know, I felt flu-like all the time and I was tired all the time and I couldn't cope. And I was, you know, I just felt sick. I didn't feel like my nervous system was dysregulated. I think what happens is we start operating on a new normal.
Yeah.
and we don't realize that this has actually happened. Yeah. So that was my game changer for me.
Yeah. So the whole GI, so gastrointestinal, and it sounds like, so Marnie mentioned SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. And then there's elements of leaky gut. So yeah, as we're describing this, you can see how much education is sort of ideal for this type of practitioner, that they really sort of have to dive into this stuff and say, okay, I'm going to specialize in all of this. This is my new area of medicine. As we go through it, and yes, the GI heavily, right? That's heavily linked to brain and mental health, the GI. It's like the second mental health system, they call it in psychology. And that aside, the nutrients and everything. So that's awesome. We'll add that to the list.
Have we talked about mold? Did we say?
Marnie, thank you. I forgot that one that we were going to loop back to. And I appreciate that so much because I still forget things. So that's also helpful. Every time it happens, I had a complete mind blank on the previous podcast episode, but I also just stopped right there and said, this still happens for me. And so I want listeners to hear that this still happens for me as well. So I knew Marnie had my back. So thank you, Marnie. So mold, that's the big kahuna. That is the, what other completely random analogies can I think of? That is the big one, mold. And they're even adding to mold now something called actinomycetes. That's sometimes trigger chronic inflammation. So that might not be a big issue for everybody, but I just want people to know the words if you see it, that sometimes people can have a low mold score, but they can have a high actinomycetes, and that can be triggering the cascade of SIRS and slowing down Lyme healing as well. But Marnie, for you, mold, I was affected by mold. It added a whole level of terror and fear to my life. But for you, tell me a little bit about your journey with mold. How did you start to feel, oh, maybe mold is affecting this whole picture for me?
Well, ironically, I was told that if early on in my treatment, if I didn't start to progress over time, about 8 months, that they would seriously look at mold.
Okay.
As it happens to be, I was progressing slowly, but I was progressing. And that's really what we're aiming for. We can't put a time frame on our journey. I actually didn't find out I had mold until after I had done a hyperthermia treatment out of country, because I was wanting to make sure that I left no stone unturned. I had no reason to think that I had been exposed to mold. We, like I said, we live in Kamloops. We're in a desert here. If I had lived in the Lower Mainland or on the island, Vancouver Island, I would have checked it sooner. Like, it's a mycotoxin panel. Anyway, the test came back positive when I was out of country. So I came home thinking, oh, I'm not done. My, you know, my journey is to wellness is not done. And that's when we discovered that we actually had an issue in my home in two separate areas. And if I could, you know, rewind the clock, I would have ruled it out sooner.
Yeah.
You know, my LLND actually.
I love that enunciation there, Marnie. Nice work.
Actually, his belief was that it didn't matter which order that you looked after what ails you, as long as you went through the complete list. Because I had switched Lyme literate naturopathic doctors after the first year. And I asked him, you know, like, why didn't we do this sooner? And his opinion was that in his experience, and he does treat a lot of Lyme patients, that the order of it didn't matter. Now, you don't often hear that in social media circles. A lot of times, that's what will advise people on, first of all, if they're having issues gaining ground with Lyme treatment, is we'll say, have you ruled out mold? So I would say that if you have the financial resources, why wouldn't you do that early? Because I believe that it could shorten your recovery time to wellness.
Right.
And we all know how long a journey this is already. And anything that can help you get to the finish line quicker is a bonus, in my opinion.
Right. Marnie, do you happen to remember, like, did you do an air sample test in your home, or was it a dust collection type of dust?
I did it. It was a dust. It was like a little Swiffer cloth. It went to the U.S.
Okay.
That's how we knew for sure that it was the house.
Yeah.
But then we didn't even know where to start. I ended up hiring a professional in occupational health and safety who doesn't do houses a lot, but he works in sciences, in building sciences. And he brought in a moisture meter, and we were able to pinpoint at least one source of, if they find moisture in your walls, there's likely mold, is the theory.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm actually still remediating my home. I had to start in one area, and now we're working on another area.
Okay, wow. Hey, still even this long through your journey, and still kind of working out those little tiny things that are affecting it.
Yeah. Sometimes it's a little bit too much to think about all of it.
Yeah, exactly. You kind of break off little pieces of what you can do, and the rest just waits. It'll wait. It has to wait. It will wait for you. What can we say to people that are having troubles with people in their lives that are not believing that mold can live in a brand new building, for example? Let's sort of dig into that a bit, or even not even necessarily brand new, but people that don't believe that mold is preventing healing. Like, what might we be able to come up with for them, if anything?
I think part of the confusion lies in the fact that our bodies are so individual. And I think that more and more often this is coming to light, and not just for people that have Lyme disease and co-infections. You know, our immune systems are quite unique. So the level at which someone can live in a home and not experience symptoms next to their partner or their children is entirely different.
100%. Yes.
For one person, it may mean the absolute worst environment for them. And for someone else, it's a non-issue.
Yeah. And I'll add a quick example right there for you. So my grandma, one of them, so she's passed away in the last sort of year and a bit now. And I would start to feel sick just going in there, even like to have a quick lunch. She lived in Calgary. I would feel just exhausted, like when I got home in the next day. And I was like, oh, my illnesses create severe exhaustion. This is just a fluctuation. Everybody else that went in there was fine. Even people in my family who sometimes have allergic reactions to mold, they were fine. So I started to try to decrease my time in there. And then after, when people were renovating our house for a sale in the future, black mold, you could see it, black mold. And I was like, okay, this makes sense now. And even other people, they started to be, over time, they had no symptoms, but in their cleaning up to sell the home, they were starting to feel sick as well. So exactly what you're saying, and that contributes to people having troubles believing it. I'm fine in there. I've been in that space for 20 years without an issue. Therefore, it does not exist in their minds. So that can be a really tough uphill battle for some people just to kind of validate that. I know in for me, I felt like I was trying to educate people on it, but I'm still coming out of my own gaslighting and confidence. So it's hard, and I don't have the words yet. So I guess if anything, and we might not have an amazing solution we can come up with for people, but maybe the test itself, that's kind of their evidence for the person. You know, it's printed, we've done the testing. So maybe the first step is just trying to get that testing and sort of negotiating with people that are not quite on the same page. Hey, let's just do the testing. And hey, if you're right, then it'll be low. It'll be like below. I don't know the numbers off my head for the reports. I know in my case, those printouts were sort of a shifter for me to have. So look, it says right here, if you have SIRS, my number is half of what the normal number is on the regular testers that work in the community. They don't know SIRS. So the numbers that are normal for them are not normal for me with SIRS and Lyme and co-infections. It's so individual. So what you're saying, Marnie, that's so, so helpful to point out. Your partner beside you, they might be totally fine. So you're convincing someone that literally it's like, I can't think of an example, but it's like you're like convincing something. Like, is it Santa an example? You're like, you know, I swear it exists. You just never get to see it, smell it, anything like that. I swear, you know, it exists. And they're like, I don't know about that. So maybe even just us sort of validating that for people going through it, they're like, this sucks. I would love to do this whole mold process, but there's these people making it be, it's really difficult. Like, I'm coming into conflicts and things. So I guess kind of jumping back for you, Marnie, did you notice that for you when you got those reports, that that was sort of the confirming point for you, like, hey, this is real, we need to sort of get on this now? Or how did it go for you going forward?
Well, as soon as I got the test results and I was coming home, I was jumping on it immediately because I wanted to feel well again.
Yeah.
I wanted to get back to work. I was tired of living my day-to-day in sickness. And so it was really hard though, navigating how we were going to do this, like who was going to help us find it, you know. And I mean, I managed to put it all together. Coincidentally, the treatment that I used with binders and such to rid my body of the mycotoxins actually had a lot less effect on my overall health compared to neural retraining.
Okay, interesting.
And that is not necessarily the norm, but I don't believe it's also uncommon, because okay, I'm still living in mold. But with the neural retraining, your body becomes less sensitive to chemical sensitivities. It could be food sensitivities, it could be mold. So I'm still going to get rid of it. It's just that I am happily living together with it right now.
You've made peace with, you know, the what's out of your control. But I also think that's important too, because not everybody can do it right away. And I remember being terrified. I remember going to my family, like I had ended a relationship. I was just unexpected. I'm having to move in with a family member, and trying to navigate all of this stuff was just, this was just enough stress to break me just in itself, this one tiny part of the whole 8-year journey. And I think a lot of people, it is exactly that. Like, it's a stress to navigate, like, which testing do I do? And then the dynamic around it. And so also I had a practitioner tell me this one, I'll say I fired her. So basically me being terrified, she told me basically, if you cannot move out of the mold, I will not treat you any further past that. If you will not move out of the mold, the treatment stops at the exact basic level we're at. I do not treat you for Lyme and co-infections. And I remember telling the people around me, I'm like, I can't, she won't treat me. Like if I can't move to a place that's low enough for the SIRS scale, like she won't treat me. And then I found my team that I'm with now, and that flexibility. Okay, you can't move out, but I think they recommend HEPA air filters, as many as you can get. There's a lot of brands. I use Air Oasis. So that's that. They recommend open windows. They recommend you getting outside, even if you don't want to, just to give your body and nervous system a rest from potentially what the cells can perceive with mold as an attack, a cell danger. Marnie's an example, just to ease your nervous system a bit, hearing this. Like Marnie is, I think you, how far healed would you say out of 100%, if 100% is pre-illness health at least or better?
I'm at 90% most
90%.
Days.
Yeah. So Marnie is an example. She's 90% healed, and that's living in a place with identified mold that she's doing her best to sort that out as soon as possible. So on the forums, when you hear the back and forth, people say 100% no, you must leave. If you can't, the show must go on somehow. So it might not be as heavy of treatment because your cells are too threatened by the mold. But it sounds like in Marnie's case, probably the brain retraining is super helpful for that, for her to be able to continue living there. Anything you'd like to add to that at all, Marnie?
Well, I think you did a very good job of both of it.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you. So you're remediating then. Now, does that involve fogging and doing that kind of remediation, or were they using air scrubbers and sort of sealing it off?
It's in the wall, so the insulation. So basically, the drywall's coming down and the insulation's being removed and replaced, and then we actually discovered the second area by accident, because we didn't really know it existed. We knew for sure about the first area, And we remediated that room. That's where we started. And then I did a thorough clean of the house because I thought that we had gotten all of it. I used a product called EC3, which my naturopath recommended.
Yeah, I have those candles as well. Yeah, okay. And they're known to drop, you could tell there's, I combined the word mold and particles. They drop mold particles from the air down to surfaces for you. I actually will light those certain spaces. Yeah, so EC3, definitely that's one that people talk about.
And my naturopath cautioned me about all the information in mold groups. He didn't believe that I necessarily had to throw everything away. What we needed to do is we needed to bring the load down. And he recommended that I do a thorough clean. And then after the mold was, you know, we get rid of the mold first. Then we do a thorough clean, light the candles, those types of things. Then we retest. And he said, as long as the testing comes within a certain limit, then you should be able to live happily in your home, which is
and again super helpful for people to hear that it's not. And this is, I think, is something you probably see in forums as well. The fear is basically, can I go anywhere? Will I be able to go anywhere?
I mean, the idea is, when you start researching mold, is that it exists everywhere in our environment, particularly outdoors. It does come down to, I think, the balances of the different molds together. So yes, certainly black mold is not good. And then for indoor air quality, it's not good for you at all. But it's everywhere in our environment. You're not going to get away from it, per se.
Yep.
The readings for mold, because I had readings done, they were higher just outside my house than they were inside.
Okay, there you go. Yeah. And that was, do you know if that was air that they sucked in for that, or was that also surfaces outside?
It was air.
Okay, there you go. So, and I had the same experience. I did that type of testing where it sucked air from outside for so it compare. And yes, there was reasonable amount of mold, different molds outside.
Yeah. My understanding was that indoors, we don't have all the different types of molds sort of balance each other out for home, for, you know, a good, healthy, it's like your gut microbiome.
Yeah.
Right.
That's good for people to know that there is mold everywhere. Now, Marnie, when you're going out and about, were you sensitive to anything like shopping centers, restaurants, staying over at hotels or anything like that?
I was sensitive to lots of light, like lighting, like, and too many people. That would have been like in my first up to diagnosis time, and then in my first few years of treatment, I was still quite sensitive. It didn't take very much for my brain to feel like it had gone over where it wanted to be.
Right. And I think you're putting the words for people with neurological Lyme right now, because I didn't have those words when I was in the worst possible state. And those are the words I wish I could explain to people. Exactly, the overstimulation, sensitivity, even a sadness, like watching a sad movie would at some point flare me up. I was like, are you kidding? So I can't be sad, I can't be happy, I can't be angry, I can't be any of these.
You know, the hardest one is realizing that good stress is bad for your body when your nervous system is dysregulated.
It
interprets it the same way. So you're trying to get back to your pre-illness living normally, and it's not as easy as it sounds, because good stress puts your body right back into
what it perceives and is ready for battle again.
Yeah,
it's like, okay, good stress.
It tells you you're not safe, and it's like, well, like, come on,
yeah. Yeah, exactly. Sort of just a vicious cycle of sorts. Yeah, but I'm glad to hear you're slowly remediating, doing what you need to do. Off the top of your head, so you were diagnosed with Lyme disease. Did you have any other co-infections with it that they diagnosed or that they clinically suspected or diagnosed?
I also had Bartonella and Babesia.
Bartonella and Babesia. Okay. Marnie has a platter of diagnosis, a long time for these infections to kind of get all through her body, brain, neurological symptoms. She's found a naturopathic doctor, an ND, who's sort of got the reins on things now. In your opinion, the enough knowledge to kind of take you through treatment.
I have an absolutely excellent LLND. I feel blessed to even live in British Columbia, where our naturopaths can prescribe antibiotics.
Well, that is so handy. That's awesome. We hear that in the groups that you guys in BC have that. I think we still don't have that here in Alberta yet. But for people looking for an ND that can prescribe antibiotics, check out BC. There's a few that are able to do other provinces as well. You're going through the treatments and everything. You know that mold is a confounding issue as well. Is there anything that sort of throughout this gave you the will to keep going or the hope to keep going? Like what, if anything, would you say helped you at the end of the day keep fighting through this? Because it sounds like a heck of a long journey, a heck of a lot of systems affected here. You're describing all the systems mostly being affected. What did you reach for throughout this?
I would have to say, like, at the top of the list is that my faith in God and my Christian background was ultimately what anchored me in trying to find the will to continue to live, because there was a point at which I did not. The journey through beating Lyme disease is not linear, and that's a very difficult to accept because you're going through highs and lows all the time. I would say that God placed some very wonderful strategic people in my life to help me beat this disease. I became an admin on a Facebook group called Lyme OO Canada. I was 1 year into my diagnosis at that point. So I've been an admin for 4 years, and being able to help others navigate this journey and or educate them on an acute infection so that they can get proper treatment early on, that kept me going.
Did you go to a church type of place for this? Did you have a community there? Or at some point during COVID, things were virtual for a while too. Was it reading biblical scriptures or all the above?
It was definitely a little bit of everything. I was raised as a Roman Catholic, but I was going to a Protestant evangelical church where I found great solace in the readings from the Bible and, you know, how they were connecting with parishioners. And ultimately, I often would go and cry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, you know, I did feel better when I left.
I feel like just that there, we need to stop and dissect that, Marnie. Because I cry frequently. Sometimes I know why I'm crying, sometimes I don't. And I'm about 75-ish% healed. And at 65, I was like, oh, yay. Like, when does it get easy? And then I hit 75 and I was like, oh, I'm crying all the time. Mine is driving my car. I process and just cry. Music. Right. I think there's obviously a point where it's like, you know, if you're becoming super depressed with the crying, but crying also physiologically is known to help balance your body back out. And there's actual chemicals and hormones found in tears that are excreted that your body wants out to sort of help with the balance and processing. So I'm all about crying, Marnie.
Good.
Right away.
I strategically put a plan in place. I always felt like if I'd been diagnosed with cancer, I wouldn't have found the journey quite so difficult, because of course you have all these other supports around you when you have cancer. First of all, your family and friends knows what that is.
Yes.
And maybe more willing to help out. There's certainly more empathy, right? I never looked sick. That was hard. I mean, that's even hard for my husband to forget that I was sick, right?
Yeah.
So I put a plan in place to help me with my mental wellness, because if I didn't have that, I never would have made it as far as I did. My mornings were the worst. Oh my gosh. Every morning has been Groundhog Day for me, right? Like my body...
Do you do a lot of your pills in the morning still? Are you still taking much now, or?
I've just almost weaned down to nothing. Not quite nothing. I'm still taking hormone therapy, which I may continue for the rest of my life. I haven't quite decided.
Yeah.
And I have just another like four supplements, you know, compared to the 20 or 25.
Wow.
You know, I mean, your life is regimented. Like, you've got to have some on an empty stomach. You've got to have some with food. You've got to have some morning, noon. I mean, you have to keep a whole list, really, to stay organized. But for the mental health aspect, I put a plan in place that would get me out of bed in the morning, generally. Because if I could get through the morning, I could flutter along through the afternoon. I mean, I might peter out by 6:30, which was fine. And I might not be productive, but at least I wasn't in bed. So I would always say, well, if I could just get myself out of bed, even if I do something for 2 hours, if at that point I do need to go back to bed, then by all means, I would go back to bed. But usually if I could get past that, you know, that getting up, I used to plan my exercise in the mornings. I used to plan a date, like a girls' outing. I mean, we had COVID right there in the middle. And actually, it was a blessing in a sense for the timing of COVID, because everyone in the whole world was plunged into uncertainty, just like I was. I was living every day in uncertainty. And now everybody else was too, just for a different reason.
I like that we both laugh at each other. Like, we're not happy that COVID affected the world and everybody in it, but it's like we're stuck. A lot of us are stuck, like in our beds or in our houses, and we're scared of contracting things that will wipe us out for a year if we get exposed to it, bacteria and viruses. And everyone else is concerned about that for a short period of time too. So we feel like we have unofficial. It's like, hey, we're not alone. If any, we're not alone now.
That's exactly what it felt like. But I started doing yoga in the last year and a half. I do daily meditations. That's quite helpful for regulating your nervous system. I thought yoga was enough. Turns out it wasn't. Getting some laughter into your everyday is so, so important. It can boost the right amount of chemicals in your brain to at least make you forget just for a little while what you're dealing with.
Yeah.
And you do have to get enough social. So planning with your girlfriends or, you know, whoever, my grandchildren, actually, in the last 2.5 years, because I became a Nona about two and a half years ago. That was a huge boost to, you know, like when you're trying to put a few things into your life that are going to make stress fall away.
Just even seeing them, probably, if you can't, or them coming over default.
Just the smile can almost instantaneously get through the day. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Anyway, I was a planner before the illness, and I felt like if I could put some planning into how I was going to tackle this journey, that it would help bring not certainty, but it would help make my body feel like I was doing everything that I could for success, right? Like we're ultimately trying to get to remission and feel better.
Yeah. It's interesting that for you planning with your day, there's a little bit of structure in there for the morning. I get the morning gloom really bad. I don't know what the, I'm just like, I literally feel like I have 10,000 pounds on my body still. So I'm still figuring that out. So I'm actually listening to how you're doing it. I might tweak mine a little bit. I started a Lyme meditation. It's through Instagram. It's called Soul Tribe Yoga. And she offers Lyme and co-infection yoga virtually to the community. So anybody listening, I'll put it in the bio of this podcast. So I started doing a few meditations there because she did it for free for Lyme patients. And she's a Lyme warrior herself. And so that's something to know about, that maybe you can do it by donation sometimes. So you just watch for the promos because she'll keep that in mind. It's not always free, but she definitely tries to accommodate. So I started doing that. I did a meditation right before this podcast because I had that nervous energy and I was like, I don't want it to be so much right before the podcast. So I listened to free on YouTube, Deepak Chopra, meditation for anxiety too. So I'm learning a little bit here from Marnie, but also What's interesting to me, Marnie, is that what you're describing is actually a strategy also for depression in psychology world. Daily structure is scientifically proven, not for everybody. So these people that are bedridden, we're not saying get up and start doing 20 jumping jacks. If that's going to make you feel sick an hour later, do not. That's not what we're saying. But a little bit of structure for people in our community is helpful because a lot of us have decision paralysis where we wake up and then we're like, oh my gosh, this whole day, I don't even know. And then you don't want to get out of bed either from that. So what Marnie is maybe without knowing, maybe she knew, I don't know, is actually it's a psychology strategy for depression. I just wanted to kind of link those two together for people. Now, again, if there's family and friends listening and they're like, see, Joe, you need to be doing this all through the day. Like, that's not helpful, per se, because Joe's not got treatment yet. Joe's still bedbound. Joe can't overexert himself, right? So I always wanted for the people in external to Lyme community coming in hot. I heard Marnie and Lacey say you need structure. No, not everybody. Maybe if they're bedbound, debilitated, maybe the only structure is that you're helping them get themselves fed, for example. But it's awesome for Marnie to say that. For some people, they might hear it and say, okay, I need to the day before write out a bit of structure or a week. Or Marnie, what would you suggest for the people that can't do it themselves quite yet? Like anything, because in your case, it sounds like you're able to make this structure, or did you have to seek help from someone to figure out what works for you?
Yeah, I was still able to put a plan together for myself, even when I was at my sickest. I wasn't able to do other things, but I was able to. I think what it was is I made it a challenge to myself. Like I thought back in my life on, you know, what in my life so far has been the most challenging and what's been the most rewarding and, you know, how I used to run marathons, for instance. And I thought, oh my gosh, like beating Lyme disease, it is going to be ultra, ultra, ultra marathon. Exponentially. Like, and how am I going to tackle that? How am I going to break it down? How am I going to make baby steps through my days? Because ultimately, you do need to implement those very, very small, minute steps, whatever they may be at whatever stage you are at.
Yeah. Yeah. And you, yeah, you said it ultra. I'm not a runner, so I know that means very, very long running. And then my brain went to like Ironmans, but no, Ironman is not that long, steady all the time. And so for those with Lyme and co-infections or those who know somebody with Lyme and co-infections, hear that. It is the long, steady sloth. And there's not just one treatment that's just, if you had it a long time, you're exempt from, unfortunately, a quick round of treatment that's going to solve the issue. You have too many systems that are shut down so you've got to reactivate them and go from there. So I really want people to hear that and validate that from themselves is like, the reason you're feeling burnt out on year five is because you've been doing it for 5 years. The reason you're feeling burnt out with your medication regime is because you've been doing that for 1, 2, 10, 20 years. I feel burnt out. I felt burnt out this morning. I looked at my pills this morning and I was like, I feel burnt out with this. Yeah, like the pills. I was like, I'm going to need to try to figure something out here. And then I said to my partner and my boyfriend, I was like, I wish I had a little friend that loves splitting capsules of pills because I split mine by hand to save money and also because I'm still too sensitive for full doses. And it's cheaper to do that than getting the pharmacy to do it. And I looked at those and I was just like, where do I find a little friend that loves fine motor tasks where you have to have tiny fingers and accuracy to not spill it over the edges? And then I was like, I don't have that little friend yet. But again, even myself with my background, I feel burnt out different days, different years, different treatments, because it's the long, long haul. And so I think what Marnie's getting at, and it's actually putting some light bulbs going off in my head here, is that kind of that reminder that like slow and steady, you can't do it all at once. If you're feeling overwhelmed, chunk it down into smaller pieces. even the trajectory of your healing, if you can, realistic expectations of yourself, so that you can then get confident and then advocate to those around you that, like, I'm going as fast as I can. You don't, like, if somebody's like running, you know, they're like about to hit the concrete, you don't come up behind them and they're like, faster, more. That's not how it works. The person hits the concrete then. Marnie does not want to be telling people to face plant into the concrete as a runner. I know she doesn't. So yeah, so I really just want people to hear that. It's slow and steady, and we're all doing the best that we can. Marnie's putting that out there, that even the whole trajectory can be, everything can be broken down, smaller, more reasonable tasks and sort of structures. I'm going to try to loop back now where we left off, because I went on a little tangent there. So we're talking about the marathon of it. To be honest, I can't remember where we were at before that.
We started out talking about how do we get through treatment? Like,
What gave Marnie the strength to pull through?
Definitely getting myself out of bed every morning, because I would feel a little bit better in the afternoons. And of course, where are we when we wake up in the morning?
Yeah, that really depends.
All right. So we've got to put something in place there to get us out of our heads and into our bodies, and even doing one small task, no matter what that is. It could be brushing your teeth. It could be eating breakfast. It could be, you know, getting out of bed and getting to the couch. It could just be that.
Could be. It sounds like really it's whatever works for the person.
I think it's very individual.
And a lot of people struggle with that morning lull. But it sounds like for Marnie and people listening, if you can just even start, that's a stepping stone, right? You're from these illnesses when you've been in bed a lot of the time, or neurological or a long time, you're not just going to hop up and start from bed to going out and doing a half day of shopping. It's a baby steps. You build slow, so slow, so slow. Like Marnie says, you just get out of bed. You could get out of bed for really... you decide 3 minutes, go back to bed after if you want, and then just slowly, slowly build there. And so that's a really good strategy to have, I think.
This disease is brutal on your mental health. Whatever you can do, like in your city, if you can get additional supports simply for mental health, because we certainly don't get supported in very many other areas of Lyme treatment. Whatever supports that you can take advantage of for your mental health, it's going to help you in your journey to health and wellness overall to beat the disease.
I would actually say the same if I was in your position here, Marnie, and someone asked me that question. I would also say if you can get a therapist of sorts, and then you can add whatever other one, you can add coach with it, whatever works for you. But the therapists also do a lot of, depending what type of therapist you choose, they actually do daily structure. Lots of practitioners I know, like they will, if they see that getting in the way of the rest of your progress, they'll say, wait, we need to sit down and break down your day. And this is our goal for therapy now. So that is in the scope of some therapists. Marnie, so Alberta, we actually, in our system here, we have some therapy covered. So it's like limited. Usually it's supposed to only be about 10 sessions, but sometimes you can push it a bit past that if the therapist feels you need, and it's free. But you have to be rated moderate to severe mental health. It's okay if you haven't looked into that. Maybe you had benefits or something along those lines. Do you happen to know if BC has something like that?
I'm not entirely sure. I know that access to mental health treatments since COVID has greatly increased. So I would imagine that there's more out there that you can access that's free. Actually, I did reach out to mental health, I mean, even prior to my diagnosis, and I was able to access some services for free at that time. So it's out there. You just have to figure out where you need to go.
And a heads up for people, if you're searching a therapist profile, look for the word sliding scale. That's what therapists used to say. If you have no income, we're going to slightly adjust the price for you. So look for the word sliding scale on their profiles, because that means that they're willing to flex their prices slightly for you. And then again, for people in Alberta, they're super helpful. And Marnie's suggestion from her personal experience is get one sooner than later if you can. If you can afford it, do it.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, if someone was to say to me, what were your worst symptoms? depression and anxiety were in the top for me.
Oh, okay.
With this disease.
So you would say those were just as bad or worse than some of the physical symptoms?
Absolutely. And because once the bacteria passes the blood-brain barrier, I had to prove to myself that we weren't dealing with a mental illness anymore. I had to prove to myself that there was something physical going on. And even though there was no doctor that up until, you know, that point had pinpointed what it is, that I knew was no longer mental health. I didn't know what it was, and I certainly didn't have any understanding that an illness such as this could cause such a severe change in, you know, my whole body.
Marnie, your level of awareness around what you just said there is incredibly progressed, by the way, because you're on to something that I've been pondering for a while. And so I'm going to take a dissection pause, as from the previous podcast, if you listen to that, that's the word I feel like going with for now, to dig, we need to piece this together, because yes, some people, these illnesses make previous mental health worse. For some people, they had no history of it. It makes it develop. It's brand new. And there's a certain level of biological and physiological processes happening inside the body that the typical anxiety strategies, they don't really phase. So there's, I don't quite have the word for it. And I've actually been trying to find it. And we might have to develop one, to be honest, at some point, because I used to be able to say it's a physiological or biologically induced depression, meaning you have a medical condition causing a large part of those symptoms. When I remove that medical condition, I'm not sure if you're going to meet the criteria for that diagnosis anymore. And neither are you, not you, Marnie, but like the person in front of me. So I don't have the word for it. And that makes me so happy that you said that, because people listening who don't have Lyme and co-infections know that there is stuff going inside of that person's head. So let's start. Yes, some people have the actual bacteria. So I don't want to scare people and use the analogy, like you've got bugs in your brain, but some of the doctors in the States, they say that your brain is on fire. Like, no wonder you're feeling so intensely these other symptoms and mental health. Like, you literally have the bugs in your brain affecting your ability to cope. They affect the vagal nerve. That is the ability to shut off the stress response. Most of us, it's debilitated. It doesn't shut off. So if we have like the tiniest little stressor, our body reaps the downward effect of that for the next 1, 2, 3 weeks, just to validate that you actually have medical things affecting your mental health. Some people had that mental health before, so I can't speak to everybody, but that's where I hope that the direction goes with these illnesses, in helping realize maybe in this case, you shouldn't feel like you're failing at this mental health therapy. Maybe there's still too much going on in your brain and your hormones, and your endocrine system, that you're not quite able to quite feel just like without mental health issues, or normal or less depressed. There's a lot of stuff that makes us feel numb, for example. So off what Marnie said, I don't have the word for it yet. But it's, yeah, again, that level of awareness for Marnie to say, I realize this is something above and beyond what would be considered mental health. And I realized that in myself too. I was like, this is just not me. I was walking my dog and my voice in my head was so loud because having a background in it, I was like, I think I might have schizophrenia at age 30. How old was I when this started? I don't know. I'm 39 now. So I've been sick for almost 8 years. So I'll let the other people do the math. So I was like, literally, I was like, this is so strange. I have every mental health strategy at my fingertips. And I feel like my voice is so loud in my head all of a sudden. This is just not me. And then like just debilitating panic attacks. I was like, this is just so much worse than I ever felt it could get. And I don't understand why. But I understand why. And what you're saying is also partly why. Until the infections are sort of managed or treated, there's a very good chance some of these things will decrease with it. However, don't opt out of Marnie's suggestion just because of that. Like, you hear that, you're like, oh, see, it's just the infections, the bugs in my brain, the brain on fire. regardless, if you can get the therapist, definitely get it, because it's always better to helpful to have someone else checking that for you. We can't always assess ourselves for mental health. Sometimes someone else needs to look at it and say, hey, have you thought of this? So thanks so much for bringing that up, Marnie.
There's also even some great books out there about how to, like, tools for dealing with anxiety, tools for dealing with depression. So don't feel like if you can't afford or you can't access services that there aren't other ways in which you can learn about how your brain is working and how you can help yourself get out of the funk, that you've all those tools that I even learned before my diagnosis were helpful to me throughout my whole treatment.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah. And again, for the people who are listening to us, and I get frustrated when I listen to things, I'm like, that's great, but I have no money. I have no way to actually do that in the location I come from. So you can get a cheap book. You can even go probably find some of these in used bookstores. You can even probably put in some support groups, like, hey, is anybody completely done with this book? You know, can we get it to me somehow? So
there are a few that you could find that were actually workbook style. And I really thought that they were the most helpful, because you're participating in what you're learning, not just reading.
Right. It's going to probably sink in better for people with our ailments. Whereas I know people tell me something verbally has gone out the other ear right away. I'm like, okay, or I'm sleeping. So yeah, so exactly. So the workbook form, as Marnie's saying, there's all different types you can find. Reach out to your sort of social communities and ask them. Marnie, so you said anxiety and depression were your absolute worst. Was there one specific point where you're like, this is my absolute worst with either one of those symptoms? For me, I hit a rock bottom. I tried to return to work too early. I was a little bit in denial or just, to be honest, unaware how severe I really was. And I couldn't get the words or, you know, to understand that. And I regressed substantially when I returned 5 days in a row to work. It was a bad news for me. And I hit my lowest point where I said, it wasn't that I didn't want to live. It was that I felt I physically and mentally could not bear the torture anymore. And so I already had a therapist at that point. We made some adjustments. I had to admit to myself, and that was really hard. Like, I really can't even go back to work now. It's not the right time. So that was my low. For me in particular, again, it was like the walking dead. And it was concerning to me, especially because I love walking my dog and he was my greatest source of continuing on. And I was just numb. I remember just walking the trail. I was just like, I can't be here anymore type of thing. I can't do this. I don't have the funds. I don't have the support. I don't have the right treatment team. And I was just like, I can't do it. I just can't. So I reached out, you know, with my background, and we sort of, again, made adjustments. We got on the right treatment path. And that in itself was enough hope for me, just getting on the right team and treatment path. Do you recall, Marnie, did you ever have any moments like that where you're kind of like, I'm at my wit's end? Or was it sort of just persistent, severe anxiety and depression?
I would say that there were few pivotal moments, you know, where you feel like you've hit bottom and then hopefully there's nowhere else to go but up. And one was when I left a therapist's office quite confidently, comfortably, and in my own skin, saying to myself, this is not a mental health issue. This is not a mental health issue.
You nailed it. Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, part of my problem was, is I had experienced issues with mental health in my teenage years. I did again in my early 30s, just after I had two children. Mm-hmm. And I had come so far, especially after my 30s, learning about the tools to avoid spiraling down, recognizing the signs and symptoms. I was actually angry at myself for how far my mental health had fallen, even though I was proactive 2 years before I left my career. I was doing everything I could to find happiness and joy in my life. Part of the issue was that I had left my career after 25 years. I'd left people that I considered my family and my friends. I was stressed beyond belief. I needed to make a change. I thought that was going to somehow not fix me, but help me get on the right path again. And then it didn't. And my kids were now young adults and they didn't need me as a motherly role. Like I was not the same person to them anymore. And which is all good because you want your kids to grow up and this is, you know, this is
just like lifting the bird to fly away. Shoot motion.
And I had all this loss in my life. And of course, I also had this disease that I didn't know I had. And so, of course, I was depressed. I mean, but then, you know, I make all these small steps to move forward with a different career path. I make, you know, different bonds with my children. And I'm, you know, looking at how much extra time I have to do what I finally can do now that my kids are grown. And I'm miserable. I'm absolutely, I don't know why. And I didn't, you know what? I've always been one of those people that push through. I think it took me a long time to realize just how actually tired I was. And one day I realized my mother had more energy than I did. And I thought to myself, well, that in itself makes absolutely no sense. How is that even possible? You know, especially based on my level of activity and the way that I ate and, you know, my lifestyle. And I hit bottom, what I consider bottom, more than once. And each time I put a new strategy in place. The problem with the one after, when I thought it was hormone related, I didn't have a next step in place. And that was a killer because I'd seen another specialist and I'd seen another and no, they can't help me. No, they don't know what's causing this. Or I go and talk to my naturopath at the time. And as much as he was a good listener, he couldn't figure out why I was sliding, you know, so far downhill. And I couldn't figure, I mean, you're powerless. That is such a defeating place to be. And especially for the length of time. Like, we're not just talking a few months here. We're talking years.
Yeah. Like the ultra marathon.
Like, you know, and there were two prominent celebrities that took their own life before I got my diagnosis. And I said to myself, this is where I'm here. This is where I'm at now. I'm not going in the right direction. If I'm going in the wrong direction, obviously I'm going to end up in a worse position where I don't want to be. So I just, you know, let's figure this out. Like I said, the next step was finding that person who was a practitioner that could support me with the Hashimoto's diagnosis and hormone therapy. Like that was that next step. And I consider myself very fortunate that the woman that I saw was Lyme literate.
Right. And hormone replacement therapy literate is also, I'm a fellow I started that at age 37, 38.
Okay.
Official bioidentical hormone replacement therapy. And
yeah,
I might be on it for the rest of my life. We'll see.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, but that can pivot someone's treatment immensely. I'm going to point out for people that if you look at what Barney's telling us, she's dealing with probably somewhere to moderate to severe level rated mental health issues at the same time of a moderate to severe physical diagnosis, at the same time affecting each different system of the body. Affecting everything, affecting ability to work. As you mentioned, you left a job after a long time. So there's, you know, processing around that and grief from how we're treated in the medical system. So the grief cycles, they just get stuck. Whereas sometimes if it's just grief you're dealing with, you go through the anger, denial, sadness, all that. And then it sort of levels a bit. With our illnesses, we never really get to fully process or deal with any of the issues. It's like we put out the fire one notch in our mental health, then we put out the fire, the hormonal chaos for biological females who have female anatomy. that in itself, one diagnosis debilitates people. I see social media accounts all the time, endometriosis, like menstrual cycles, early menopause. I'm somewhere around early menopause symptoms myself. But yeah, so when you put it like that, the question is not why would Marnie be depressed and anxious? The question is why wouldn't Marnie be depressed and anxious? And I think we really want to drill that in here. Why wouldn't Marnie be depressed and anxious? There's not many people that I know that sit in that for longer than 1, 2, 3, 5, 10 years and don't hit a breaking point. So it's more it's a matter of how you deal with it if and when it comes type of thing. In an ultra marathon, you expect maybe one central system, so maybe your mental health, to be affected. That's a battle enough that puts people on disability, medically recommended sometimes. You know, I think I kind of want to switch that to, you know, why are some of these people depressed? Why aren't they? How would you not be with all that going on and still having bacterial and viral loads not quite managed in your body and things treated? It's interesting for Marnie to tell us that even at 9, you know, going the later parts of healing, still kind of working some of these things out. And so today, now, Marnie, how is the depression and anxiety these days?
Well, we're still on a roller coaster. I thought that last year, I'm going to say summertime last year, I had been doing 6 months of neural retraining at that point. Things were coming along really well. And I was starting to get back to a 40-hour work week. And with that comes more responsibility, more decision-making. And what actually happened, looking back at it now, is that my body said no. My brain was saying, yes. But my body was calling up some old trauma from previous years where I was working and every day was, I've just got to get through today. I've just got to get through today. Or I've just got to get through this week. Or I've just got to get through this month. I've just got to get to, like, I mean, how many years did I operate that, like that? So right now I am still currently working on neural retraining, and I'm going to be focusing more on the trauma aspect in a few more weeks because I was so excited to get back to a 40-hour work week. This has been my goal. Now, why has that been my goal? Well, I worked part-time when my kids were young, and so I really don't feel like I've had enough time to make a mark on the world, I suppose.
Okay,
and And I do have my own business now, and I work part-time in another area, but I still feel like I have something to offer, and yet now my body is holding me back because my nervous system shuts me down, and I hit that cell danger response, and it's anxiety. It's actually so much more than anxiety. It's like a trigger, and I've got to find ways to help my body, first of all, recognize it in the different stages that it's in so that I can shut it down and learn more tools on how to bring my body back to more homeostasis. Still, hopefully being able to put forth a 40-hour work week, which is exciting to me. Where I can have this routine where, you know, I work Monday to Friday and I get my weekends off, and which, you know, has been my goal since I left my previous career, like so many years ago now. So that's where I'm at. I've started a different neural retraining program that has a little bit more emphasis on trauma, I believe.
Okay,
has that?
Yeah.
And
are you comfortable to share the name of that one?
Sure. I've signed up for Primal Trust.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Primal Trust. Mm-hmm. We hear a lot about that one in the community.
Prior to that, I did the Gupta program, and I have only good things to say about the Gupta program as well. But having had a setback, which they tell you is not uncommon, but you know, here we are. I am in remission. I've been in remission for more than 2 years, and I'm still having setbacks. So
there you go. Hey,
so I think that's just puts it into light how long the journey is and where you need to sort of place your expectations, because life is beautiful and there are so many reasons to live. And, you know, you have to find ways to manage the setbacks. And I'm in another huge one right now, because what happened is that all of a sudden the fatigue came back, the anxiety came back, the not wanting to get out of bed came back, all from a dysregulated nervous system.
Right, right.
And I had no idea that that would happen to me again at this point, that, you know, I would start working again and have some responsibility and start dealing with people again and all of this. With all, it's exciting. And but my body says, no, what are you doing? Like, right?
I laugh, but it's just, you're hitting home for me right now. It's exactly what I'm experiencing right now as well. Yeah.
I have this phrase that it's not over when I lose, it's over when I quit.
Okay. Yeah, so let's say that again. It's not over when I lose, it's over when I choose to quit.
Yeah. So there is no option to quit here.
Yeah.
That's not one of my choices, unless something else comes along that I can't control.
Right.
But this is something with working with the brain and the body. I mean, people that go to war deal with these issues. People that have you know, have been abused, people that, like, I just didn't know that because I'd lived through a long journey of chronic illness that my body would respond in the same way.
Right.
And shut down. I didn't know that that could happen.
Yeah. But so the degree of resiliency that you're describing, again, you're doing an ultra marathon. You're dealing with not one, but almost all your systems affected by it. You're dealing with not one diagnosis that puts people on medical disability. You're dealing with 1, 2, 3, 10. Some people are up in the 400 different symptoms. and I know you mentioned it can mimic 300. I actually can probably add on a couple other 100 that I've seen myself that I would add on there. So again, the question is, not why is this hard for people like Marnie and I in the community, is like, how would it not be? How would it seriously not be? Look at the degree of resiliency. Marnie's 90% healed. She's still hitting road bumps. So what Marnie's saying there is how you come to manage those road bumps. And for those listening, what she's describing casually is that's a big, for me, when I experience those kickbacks, It terrifies me. And you have to catch your brain from going down that exact rabbit hole again. Like, I'm going to be sick forever. I'm going to start from square one. You have that saying. I'll get you to say it again for us.
It's not over when I lose. It's over when I quit.
Yeah. So it sounds like that's Marnie's go-to there. So that's a really good go-to, because the resiliency required for these illnesses is unfounded. You don't get as far as Marnie without some degree of resilience built inside of you at your core. So Marnie, I think you started to say, so it sounds like you still have struggles ongoing with the mental health. Myself, my nervous system is fragile still too. And you mentioned some neural retraining program. You've given some good advice there, some good personal experience. Primal Trust, I've heard lots about that one. But you're definitely giving me some lights going off in my head that I also need to sit down and talk with some of these people here. I can't speak that they'll say yes because I haven't asked them. So, but I think that's really necessary for the community at some point to be able to like choose between them and why. Whereas right now it's presented as like all of them, and you're like, okay, what do you specifically offer in each one? We need to know that as patients before, you know, at some point what we're buying into. So thank you so much for those suggestions. I remember Marnie in the social media groups, the Lyme OO Canada group, that's been super helpful for me to ask questions. And actually Marnie, I remember you answering some of my questions in there. And I remember seeing, and if I dig through my messages, you mentioned something about, for people with foot pain, a specific type of shoe. So what experience has brought you to be familiar with a type of shoe that is sometimes more helpful for people with Bartonella symptom feet or even Lyme and Co feet, which can be excruciating pain in a normal shoe?
I started a part-time job shortly after COVID hit. And it was to get me out, to get me social. And it was a sales associate position at a local running, walking specialty shoe store. It's called Runner's Soul here in Kamloops. And we carry a line of footwear called Hoka. And the Hoka Bondi is one shoe that I can recommend to anyone who's got foot pain.
Okay. So that was, if I'm being true disclosure here, which I should be for my podcast listeners, I wanted you to remind me for me, because I want to get a pair of shoes. My feet, according to my partner and boyfriend, why do your feet look like a man's foot? And I was like, because no matter what I do, no matter what shoes I wear, they get these, it doesn't matter how much I tend to them, file them, moisturize them, they're just as sore and they're just as wrong placed support. It's not cutting it. So I wanted to know, again, a reminder. So thank you, Marnie. It sounds like in BC, do you happen to know for us Albertans or the Calgary area off the top of your head, if there's a store we might have these shoes, or would we look for that brand online and try to find the Hoka Bondi for those?
Well, I would find, I don't know of a name currently, but I'm sure that Calgary's got a running and walking specialty shoe store.
Okay,
And if they are up with what's happening in the industry, they are carrying that shoe.
Okay, awesome. So I'll look into that for myself for sure. It's time. And I remember, so just to show like your impact from groups like Lime OO Canada, I remember you recommending that to someone else on there. I screenshotted it. It's 6 million screenshots somewhere in my phone now. And you even sent it to me. And it's, again, hundreds of, I have no idea where it went. So that's awesome. And now, in terms of a sole in your experience for people with our issues, like what type of sole?
Going to, if you're wanting an over-the-counter insole, you're going to want to look at brands like Sole, Form, or Superfeet.
Sole, S-O-L-E, and then Form, F-O-R-M?
Yeah, or Superfeet.
Superfeet. Oh, I like the sound of that one.
I should also mention that the Hoka Bondi fits, I'm going to say, 80% of our customers and does the job well. But if you go to a running and walking specialty shoe store, if the Hoka Bondi does not fit your foot profile close enough, they'll have something else there that will.
Okay.
Okay. What you're looking for is a shoe that if you hold it at its tip and its heel, you can't twist it. Okay. You need a sturdy base.
Okay. So kind of firm or sturdy, as you say.
Yeah.
So can't twist it. Top to bottom, you shouldn't be able to twist it like a snake bite. It should keep its form.
Yes. You want a strong heel counter.
Okay.
Right. Like that heel counter. Like generally Skechers falls nowhere in this area of what I'm talking about.
Okay.
They might have one, but Skechers, you can usually take that heel counter and it'll collapse on itself. That is not doing your foot any favors.
Okay, so that's partly why my feet look like a man's foot. No disrespect to a man's foot. Maybe you have beautiful feet as a man. My partner just chose to use that example. So thank you, Marnie. I appreciate that. That's good for me and others to know. And so, okay, so you've told us so much helpful information and where you're at now. And has anything helpful or positive come of this really, really difficult diagnosis and other diagnoses that come with it in terms of future endeavors, or has it immersed you in the Lyme community for any type of collaboration or work that way?
Well, I've definitely, as I've continued to heal, stepped up my advocacy efforts a little bit more. I have a PowerPoint that I can present to groups for education and awareness around Lyme disease if they're so interested. I've done a couple over Zoom.
So I'll hang on here one sec. So is that still active? So if I come across someone that I feel them and their family are really stuck on the understanding of Lyme disease itself and what to do going forward, is that something that people can reach out to you, or is your plate still full with your other things?
Well, I do have the article that I also wrote in addition to my PowerPoint.
Okay. So yeah. That's a good starting point then.
That's a very good starting point.
So we can refer people right to that article for now then.
We can, for sure.
Awesome. Okay. So you sent me that article, and to fill people in, I know it goes through an explanation of Lyme disease and co-infections. I saw also at the bottom, there's prevention. Anything else kind of from top to bottom that I'm missing for people to know what's in this pretty easy to access article?
The idea behind the article, and I wrote it a year after my diagnosis, so this was in 2020. It has been updated several times since then.
Okay, that's good. That's very good for current and research.
I do keep that updated date on the article, but I wanted to be able to communicate to the general public and family and friends and whomever about the most important points about the disease, because Lyme disease is like no other. You can't go to your doctor and get accurate information on Lyme disease. And most people, our lives are busy. We all have different priorities. And how could I condense the most important information about Lyme disease in an easy to read format with credible sources linked in the article, and also make it short enough that the reader can read the whole thing, but make it long enough and touch on the most important points to actually get you to think about the seriousness and the urgency surrounding Lyme disease? Because this there was a study done in 2018 by two very credible Lyme experts, and they estimate that only 3-4% of Canadians are getting an accurate diagnosis when it comes to Lyme disease.
Yeah.
Everyone else in Canada is either being misdiagnosed with an autoimmune illness, or they're not getting diagnosed, and or they're put on mental health drugs because it's all in their head. You know, like that. When I researched the disease, after I wanted to find out how come it could possibly take 10 years to get an accurate diagnosis of something that's known, I was horrified by what's going on in our country with respect to this illness. You have to research what happened in the US to understand why it is where we are here today in Canada. So that's the article. The article links to some really good documentaries, which I suggest people watch. It gives you some key facts so that you can very quickly raise your knowledge. And then if someone in your family, if by chance gets bitten, or someone has a question and they don't know where to go, then they can remember that article is on the internet and easy to access.
And available 24/7. Yeah. You're having a heated conversation with someone not believing you on the phone. Like, here, just check out this link, please.
Because this is more than a 15-minute discussion. Because most of us were taught to respect our doctors and that they would know. Like, right. You know, if your doctor says there is no Lyme disease in Kamloops, you'd think that they would know. But the answer is that it's not their fault, but they don't know.
Right. The reality in what we have to come to accept is that exactly that person either doesn't know, or they've been shaped by information sort of false, to be honest. Like, they've maybe heard from their peer who said, hey, there's a faulty labs in the States, don't trust the diagnosis. So they say, oh, another physician told me that, so I'm going to tell my patient that confidently. And so, as you said, a lot simply have no idea. It's not taught in their programs in any shape or form.
That's correct. Yeah. Yeah. And the article goes on to explain why that is. And I think it's important for Canadians to understand why that is.
Yeah,
because it is important for them to understand, because then they know that they have to advocate for themselves for diagnosis and treatment.
Right.
Because if you have Lyme disease, the sooner that you can treat it, the better your chances are at a full recovery and the less length of time it's going to take to find health and wellness. And the financial strain of this disease is astronomical.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and not everyone can afford treatment. It breaks my heart. I was fortunate in that I had my house paid for when this happened. So I didn't have a mortgage to pay. No, I was not making ends meet, which was horrifying to me at the age of 50.
That
I was spending more than my family income, my husband's income was bringing in.
Yeah.
And that I couldn't continue to save for my retirement.
Right.
But,
yeah.
But, right. Like in my most formative years, because I started at 20, but though I lost my formative years to save for my retirement, but I do have most of my life back.
Right. Yeah. At a cost.
At a cost.
A high cost. But it sounds like if there's any way to start getting some balance back in that income, you need to get your health back.
Exactly.
So, or as much as needed to be able to actually make an income of any sort. So, yeah. And I think that a lot of people will hit home for them depending on age, because for some ages, they're not thinking about the retirement as much. But in the way, especially with economies right now, is you're seeing that. You're seeing this is not going to stretch far at all. Like can I even retire anytime soon? Right. It's all those questions for someone. And that's stressful too sometimes.
Yeah.
So I really appreciate that you're sharing that. I'll definitely link that so people can see that. I think it's a really helpful resource to have. For some resources, we're a little bit behind our American neighbors, because I was sort of picked up by the resources from our American neighbors, a lot of them. I kind of felt like I was calling out like, hello. It was just like silence of time. The Lyme OO Canada group was an amazing resource for me. But in terms of agencies that are developed, we are hoping to catch up a bit here. And that's what I'm hoping to do with this podcast eventually, is bridge some of those gaps, start to get the ball rolling a bit, letting people know and interconnect with all these resources that we do have. Do you happen to know, in your area in BC, have you heard of any Lyme fundraisers or anything like that?
Coincidentally, actually, in Kamloops, there was a young woman who worked with two others, I believe, and co-founded a Lyme Walk in Kamloops. So this was back in 2018.
Okay, yeah.
And it wasn't a fundraiser, but it was a walk for Lyme, where Lyme patients from across the different communities could come and walk together, hopefully be supported by some friends and family members, but to show the community that, yes, indeed, we do have Lyme disease here. 2019, we had another walk, and then 2020, it was a virtual walk with COVID. So just this year, 2024, I felt that I was well enough to take on the responsibility of bringing the walk back to Kamloops. Because we called it Walk for Lyme, Jen's Journey, and Jen was one of the co-founders of the original walk. So we told her story. And we also thanked her for her advocacy efforts so far. Jen still struggles with quite a few symptoms and wasn't able to carry it on. And so I sort of carried the torch, and I'm hoping that it will be an annual event. I did structure the new format with a fundraiser involved to raise money for the G Magnata Foundation.
What is the G Magnata?
Yeah, G Magnata Foundation. They are out of Eastern Canada, and they support a lab in the University of Guelph. Their mission statement is to improve the way that Lyme disease is tested and treated in Canada.
Good to know.
But they're Canadian, because, right, it's really hard to find. You're right. Like, we are many, many, many years behind the U.S., however, the epicenter of Lyme did start in Eastern US. So it stands to ground that we are behind. But yeah, so it took place the first Sunday in May, because May is Lyme Disease Awareness Month. And we had a successful event, in my opinion. We reached people that had no idea that Lyme disease was an issue here in Kamloops, and the whole idea was to get the word out within our community.
Okay, that is fantastic. Again, because we are sort of searching for these things happening here in Canada, it sounds like if health allows, potentially you'll be holding the torch next year. And if you have to pass it, it might carry on then with someone else. But is the goal then to have it next year as well in May?
The goal is that as long as I am able, Kamloops will have a walk for Lyme. Yeah.
Awesome. And you said there's been some virtual join-in options.
Well, we did virtual join-in in 2020. I didn't structure it that way this year, but perhaps in the future, I hope to work with more of a committee next
right.
year.
Now that I
understand all of what needs to happen behind the scenes, I would like to work with others that are interested in the same focus as myself. And really, it's around, besides supporting one another, it's educating the community.
Right.
I mean, it's so frustrating that mainstream media hasn't blown this out of the water in Canada yet.
Right.
Even W5 that did a documentary, you know, a broadcast a few years ago, they only scratched the surface. And when we all emailed them to say, when is your next segment? They said that the story had been told.
I did what dogs do. And they're like, huh? I put my head to the side. I felt my neck, my cervical spine cracks. It's like, so I hear that in my headphones. But that's the story they shared. But obviously there's thousands of other stories still.
It's if this wasn't so far outreaching to absolutely everyone. I mean, you can't even say that, oh, well, I don't go hiking and I'm not camping, so I'm not at risk. Our blood supply isn't screened for tick-borne infection. Everyone is at risk for Lyme disease. And then because it's not being diagnosed in mainstream medicine, this is a huge health issue that we have. And it's almost criminal what's been left to happen, because we know how many people that this potentially is going to affect and has already affected.
Right. Yeah.
It's not
going away anytime soon.
No. And
unfortunately,
I really struggle with it in my mind when I found out how serious of an issue it is. And what I've lived through, it rocks my world. So whatever I can do in the next however many years to make baby steps forward in the right direction, because that's all it's going to be. But baby steps can get you to remission, and baby steps can help secure a better future for my grandchildren in this country with respect to diagnosis and treatment.
You're doing it for those that are going to be here when we're not, even the younger generations, that maybe it'll trickle down eventually, and maybe they'll have a bit more awareness when they're engaging in activities, because there is so much prevention that you talk about in your article. It's mind-blowing, even for me with my past history, coming from my past work experiences in life, it's mind-blowing. But baby steps is exactly what you're doing by keeping this walk going. And it sounds like you're putting an unofficial call out. I'm going to make it for you to people listening. If people want to help Murnie out with the process next year, let's keep it going. In an ideal world, maybe not next year, maybe not the year after, we'll have one in every province.
So
I'm putting the call out for Murnie.
I'd like the idea to catch on.
We want one in every province.
We want, so. Yes, we do.
So yeah.
And more than
find Marnie. Don't overtax her nervous system, though. I'm shaking my finger in the screen.
Yeah.
And so Marnie cannot overtax herself. And all of us have to promise ourselves that we're not going to overdo it. So whatever Marnie's health allows with this project is what will develop. So, but still, you guys out there that can help her, please do. There, I put the call out, Marnie.
Awesome. Thank you. And, you know, honestly, it's even more about ideas and a direction and just working with others together to see something come to fruition. I worked with people all my life, and I now, my job at home is like, I don't have coworkers, and I really miss the team approach to a lot of what I do. And, people can just, you know, join in with ideas. They don't necessarily have to commit to they don't have to commit to taking on a task.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It just means that you're going to be involved in some shape or form, and you don't have to have Lyme or co-infections. People that are going to listen to this, you're not in this world. If you want to just start a huge volunteer committee for Marnie and what needs to be done going forward, I'm hesitant to even where to direct people to, because I don't want to crash my nervous system either. But let's say
I do have like an email address. It's kamloopswalkforlyme@gmail.com.
Okay, so let's write that on here. kamloopswalkforlyme, and we'll talk, and we'll get that all kind of posted with the podcast, so that if people are wanting to help, they at least you can go through the list maybe of getting people in there. And I'm sure, even in forum, it's out there now. Marnie's provided her email. I just expect sometimes the replies will be slower when people are still healing from these things. So be patient, and as our health allows, we'll get back to all of these things. So I love that this is, it's putting it out there. That's the first step. So it's super exciting. And the way that you said that even people that don't have Lyme and co-infections, we want them to be involved in these walks too. So if you can support Marnie in that area, or other areas, if it trickles down to other provinces, we'd love that help and support. That is awesome, Marnie. And because unfortunately I can't keep you or listeners here for super many hours at a time, I'd love to. My question for you is there any last thing that you'd like to share with the Lyme and co-infection community, that just it can be anything, or something you wish you might have heard from somebody that's come out the other end of it?
There's got to be something. You need to reach out. And being someone with Lyme disease where you don't look sick, you need to reach out to others that are going through the same challenges that you are. Same but different. Could be great, because we all have different, and like, don't isolate yourself. It is so bad for your mental health. And just connect in any way that you can, because you could be at any level in this journey, but it's just so important to connect. I can honestly say that it's the connections that I've made, right, that speak to my soul, that keep me going.
There you go. Right? Yeah. The community it's hard for me to put in words, so I'll just use what you said. The same for me in the community. Those are the people that they're willing to help when they're dealing with terrible illnesses themselves. They're going to try in whatever way they can. Connecting with people going through the same thing. Some of those people hopefully are on healing journeys. So a mix. Some people that have already come out the other end and what they can share. And some other people in the early phases. But that connection and community is key. And that community is pretty darn amazing, if I might say so myself. You can't put into words. If you would never meet these people otherwise, and you just know you've both been through so much, and the resilience and everything and kindness in the community is amazing. And I'm sure we'll both give props to the Lyme OO Canada group. You can post questions in there about your treatments and get personal experiences, no medical advice, because we would never do that in, you know, social media. So personal experience with those same treatments, anything like that. If you're in Canada, check out that group for sure. I have to extend my thanks to Marnie for giving us her time, maybe getting her nervous system a little riled up, but maybe not before. Mine was a little riled up before. I'm so super cautious about that going forward. My nervous system's super calm now. I would like to, on behalf of everyone, thank you for your vulnerability around these topics. Thank you for your work you do in the Lyme OO Canada group. Thank you for helping me in the Lyme OO Canada group in the past and not even knowing it at the time. And thank you for carrying some of these things on and not letting the Lyme community fall out of your sight, because you're healing as well. I appreciate that tremendously. And I look forward to, seeing what comes, what our nervous systems allow for in the future. So thank you so, so much, Marnie, for chatting with us today.
Thanks, Lacey. I was honestly a pleasure to speak with you today.
I appreciate that. All right. Well, that's that. That's the end of today's podcast. I'm going to end it here and hope people check in to future podcasts and check out this one as well.